This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. World trade, that's not necessarily a subject many of us tend to think about. We're more interested in the size of our paycheck and the cost of living. But there are some troubling trends in world trade that threaten to have a major impact on the size of your paycheck and the cost of living. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Robert Morley about the fact that world trade has plateaued for about the last 20 months. We'll talk about why and the effects that tend to follow when nations aren't trading with each other as much, and why this is something we really need to be concerned about. Drug use is a big subject in America today, with marijuana having been legalized in 4 states already and on the ballot to be legalized in several more this November. But did you realize that more Americans than ever are dying from drug overdoses? An amazing number of those are happening because of prescription opioid painkillers. We're going to talk about what is causing this steep rise in drug overdoses and what it tells us about America today. Is the Bible actually true, and is it reliable? The field of archaeology is providing more and more evidence that the answer is, in fact, yes. We'll talk to Chris Eames, who's worked on archaeological digs in probably the most important biblical site, Jerusalem, about some examples of archaeological proof of the Bible. And I'll conclude the program by talking about the importance of understanding the mysteries of your own complex and sometimes contradictory thought processes and how the Bible can help. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. World trade is slowing down. It's actually plateaued since January of 2015. And this is causing a lot of people tremendous concern, because when trade slows down, oftentimes nations begin to get more competitive with each other. They start implementing policies that are aimed at stealing market share from other nations, and this can create other, even more serious problems. A new study has found that, in fact, this problem is being made worse by the rise of protectionist measures by several nations. And to learn why this is so dangerous and where it could lead, we're going to turn to Trumpet writer Robert Morley. Hello, Robert.
Good to be here.
It's great to have you back. You've been traveling on the road for quite a bit lately, but back in the studio. So start by just telling us about this study that brought some of this out, what some of the key findings were.
Sure. This study was produced by Global Trade Alert, their think tank, and they published this study about a month ago now. And this study was very, very stunning to a lot of people for a couple of reasons. I think one of the reasons it got the headlines it did was because it found that since January of 2015, global trade had essentially stalled. Basically, the growth in global trade, commerce between nations, imports and exports, all those things you hear about, that has flatlined. It hasn't grown at all for more than a year and a half now, which is very, very problematic on a number of fronts. And another thing from this study that they found is that even before the last year and a half, global trade had slowed down dramatically since the economic crisis in 2009. They found 2008, 2009, they found that global trade, the growth in global trade only averaged over these last 7 years has only averaged about 3% growth per year, which is dramatically slower than what it had, what we've experienced over the previous 30. The previous 30, global trade average on average grew about 6% a year. So suddenly we have this economic crisis. Global trade has slowed dramatically, and now it's hit stall speed. And they say that's pretty much unprecedented, except for in times of severe global economic recession or depression. So these things have happened when global trade has stopped before, but only in times when there's a severe economic depression. So they're asking the question, you know, what is going on right now? We're looking around the world and you hear all the experts like Janet Yellen and the various political leaders, and you know, supposedly we're in this recovery, right? We have, we're talking about raising interest rates. When are we going to raise interest rates? Because, you know, we're in this global recovery now. Well, if we're in this global recovery,
It's hard to run away from this number.
Yeah, it is. Why?
So you would have expected it in 2008, 2009, maybe as the things were falling apart. But by now, this should be reversed.
Right. The recession supposedly ended 2012, right? 2011, 2012. So the question is, what's going on? And the report's authors draw some pretty disturbing conclusions from that. And
I'd like to just get into the causes. Like if they're looking at this and being able to pinpoint some of the things that are creating these conditions, and then we can talk about ramifications and what might happen in the future as a result.
Yeah, absolutely. So the authors of this report point to one thing as the primary cause, and they say that it is the growth of protectionist measures. So they have actually done surveys. They've collected data from all the nations around the world, and they've looked at the various laws that have been passed by various governments, and they do a running tally of that. And what they've found is that there's been a pretty dramatic rise in protectionist measures, and especially in the last 2 years.
So this is something that Americans should be familiar with. In the middle of this campaign season, we're hearing quite a bit, at least from the Republican side, just making sure that we're making trade deals that favor America. Maybe you could just talk about what protectionism is and the effects that that has.
Yeah, absolutely. When you hear Donald Trump talking about America First policy, America First, you know, make America great, or whether it's Hillary Clinton talking about her aversion to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that global trade deal that's being worked out, both of those are symptoms of a world that, as symptoms of, you know, populations that are very disenfranchised, I think, with globalism and globalization and even free trade, this idea that goods and services and money should be able to flow freely across borders. And this really is what you see happening when economic conditions deteriorate. Historically, we've seen this, and it seems like we're seeing those same things again. So back to your question about what is, you know, this protection is when, you know, governments, regulatory bodies throw up obstructions to free trade. So whether it's things like tariffs, you know, or duties, or, you know, extra taxes, or any of those measures that increases the cost for your competitors, other nations bringing in goods, that slows down that trade, gets in the way of it. That's what protectionist measures. That's what the study authors are talking about.
Now, this is really interesting because we really have a push and pull between two very real market forces or, say, interests. You can see where that sort of impulse toward protectionism comes from, that people are concerned about the loss of jobs overseas. They're concerned about, say, the depression within manufacturing within the nation at home. You can see why people tend to favor that, and especially as the world becomes more dangerous and more factors increase that would cause them to be more concerned about what's happening and their interactions with other nations. But this does have ramifications from a global standpoint. This does tend to have an impact on all kinds of nations in terms of their national economies.
Absolutely. You're completely correct about Stephen Roach, former chief economist for Morgan Stanley. He just came out with an article published in Project Syndicate, I think, a couple of months back. And he's talking about the failure of globalization and the failure of elites to really communicate to the working class the benefits of free trade. And he says, you know, there are very real problems in the economies today. There's no doubt about that. We are having rising unemployment. We're having this disconnect between the rich, you know, the haves and the have-nots. And these are huge problems. But what we're seeing now is, you know, the populism, the reaction to the masses of unemployed people, the reaction to people who are looking at their finances and saying, you know, I'm going to have a lower standard of living than my father, and my kids are going to have a lower standard of living than me. And politicians are reacting to that, and they're starting to throw up a lot of these barriers, these protectionist type things that are supposedly designed to keep jobs in, you know, America or in whatever country you choose, pick your country. And we're seeing a lot of these restrictions come up in place basically as a reaction to these very real problems. Now, the danger is these supposed solutions, these trade barriers, these tariffs, these taxes, you know, bring the jobs back. Over the short term, those will be very, very painful. That's what history shows. Every time we've had, every time the world's gone through these bouts of protectionism or reactions against globalization, it's always been economically very, very painful for the people that the politicians are supposedly trying to help.
So what, I mean, it is interesting because we're looking at a global economy that really is interconnected and interdependent in a way that is historically unprecedented, and the amount of effect that the decision of one nation has on another nation, it's never been as great as it is today. So this nation sneezes and everybody else catches a cold. That's the kind of climate that we're in. But what are some of the effects that will happen now that some of these protectionist measures are being put into place? They're talking about the plateau of global trade. What happens next?
Right. Well, that's a great question. If you can go to history to see what's happened in the past, you know, if you want to go back to the classic example of the Great Depression and lead up to World War II, you can even look in the lead up to World War I. These same sort of things started happening with the protectionist measures increasing, and that led to a lot of economic and social pressure at that time in the lead up to those wars. So, for example, when tariffs go up between nations, when trade is restricted, businesses that could normally sell, you know, take your car, automobile manufacturing, businesses that could normally produce cars at home and sell them overseas, that stops. So what happens then? Well, their production slows down. They're not producing as many cars. They're laying off people at home. Social problems increasing, financial problems increasing. But there's all kinds of knock-on effects from that. They're not building as many cars. They don't need as much iron. They don't need as much steel. They don't need to import, you know, computer chips from South Korea. They don't need to, bring in tires from Indonesia. All these kind of things that just have these cascade type effects that, if you're not careful, can snowball very, very quickly. Now, a lot of people who are for protecting domestic industry, they'll say, well, maybe that'll happen, but over time we'll start building up our own industries internally. And that might be true, and there is some validity to that, but that always takes time. And there's a lot of destruction that takes place first, and that's very, very painful. And that can lead to a lot of unemployment and a lot of social unrest and social problems.
There are, it seems to me, some tremendous moral lessons that we can take from this, because we really have built an economy that is, it demands endless growth. And the whole concept of, you know, sourcing everything at the cheapest place and exporting it to the place where you can get the most profit from it, it creates these interdependencies that, if they're broken, have some serious consequences to them. You know, there are the people who would look at, say, the problems associated with the globalization and say this is an inevitable result of that kind of interdependency versus more localized economy and so on. But it's like we're trapped by this system, and we really should be able to. These effects that you're describing here, these are the inevitable result of the kind of economic edifice that we've built here.
Yeah, it's interesting that you make the point about the world's economy needing this perpetual growth. And that certainly is the case when you have the debt levels that we have. I mean, when you look around growth and our economy, say it's all financed by debt. So you need to have that growth or the whole thing comes crashing down. It's also interesting you mentioned about the localized economies and that sort of thing. I think going forward, you know, that will be much more of a model that this world will need to embrace if there's going to be prosperity. And we're actually seeing even little glimmers of that today in some ways. Like, you know, with the rise of a lot of these renewable energy technologies, it's making, and with the rise of robotics, we're starting to see a lot more. The United States isn't losing the jobs it has to foreign cheap labor. You know, and there's some things like that that have actually been little revivals in localized communities, even in the United States and other areas that have been hit hard by, you know, outsourcing in the past.
Can you give us a sense of what may, looking at this from the standpoint of biblical prophecy, how this may play out in a way that fulfills the way that you would expect?
Yeah, absolutely. This is something we've been writing about for many, many years, and Herbert W. Armstrong was writing about for many years before that. Back in 1968, Herbert W. Armstrong talked about trade wars and what would follow on those trade wars, meaning world wars. And really that is prophecies of your Bible. You can look at prophecies in Leviticus and Deuteronomy about, you know, the blessings and cursings, but also talking about economic problems and the United States and Britain in particular being besieged by their enemies. And when you take a look at that word and you take a look at that prophecy, that really is economic in many aspects. That is one of the main prophecies, or a big prophecy we're looking at going forward, economically speaking, is to see an increase in these types of trade protections and trade wars and financial and economic war preceding actual hot war.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Robert Morley. He's working on an article on this subject. You can watch for that online at thetrumpet.com. It's great to have you back in here, Robert.
It's nice to be home.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Drug overdoses are killing more Americans than at any time in history, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In 2014, over 40,000 Americans died of an overdose. That is a disaster on the scale of the Syrian Civil War. Now, that's amazing, but what's even more amazing is that the most deadly drug, accounting for about two-thirds of all overdose deaths, is opioids. And the drugs that account for the great majority of those deaths are prescription opioid painkillers. This is a serious problem, and trumpet writer Andrew Miller is working on an article about this. Hello, Andrew.
Great to be in the studio.
So, give us a sense of the scale of the problem that we're talking about here.
Well, yeah, like you mentioned before, I mean, 47,000 people dying in America. That's roughly like 85% the death toll of the Syrian Civil War, which I think was 55,000 for that same year, or also right on par with like the death toll of the cartel crisis in Mexico, which is linked very closely with this problem we're going to be discussing, and that's not the overdoses, but that's just people getting shot in Mexico as a result of drug trafficking. So it is a huge, even humanitarian crisis, and it's really starting to call into question a lot of the stereotypes that you have about drug addiction. Normally, you hear the word drug addiction, and you conjure up images of maybe a high schooler who got caught up with a bad crowd, or maybe someone from an inner city ghetto injecting heroin. But they're actually showing that like two-thirds of these deaths are resulting from prescription drugs. In some cases, you'll get people who are actually prescribed a drug and get addicted. I think in probably more cases than that, you're just getting where you've got these very powerful, even like opium-based painkillers being over-prescribed. And then if there's just flooding the market with these things, even if the person with the prescription's not the one using them, it's real easy for someone to break into your medicine cabinet and get these out on the streets where they're, like I said, they're opium-based, so I think heroin is definitely the most deadly of the illegal drugs because it's opium-based. More, it kills twice as many people as cocaine and several times as many people as many other legal drugs. But even of the legal drugs, it's definitely the opium-based painkillers that are killing the majority of people when they abuse them.
So the you mentioned two-thirds of the overdose deaths are being caused by prescription drugs.
Yes, I think I've got the statistics here. And it's something like 25,000 people based off prescription drugs. Now, granted, a lot of those are using, or actually the majority of those are using the prescriptions in a way the doctor didn't prescribe. But still, that is two-thirds. And the Center for Disease Control has really been coming down hard on the pharmaceutical industry lately for being just a little trigger happy with their prescription pads.
Well, let's talk about that. If there, do we have any kind of sense of how much of, say, the prescription drugs that are making their way out there and that people are taking, how much of that is because of prescriptions versus, say, theft or other means that people might have, or black market use that people might have of getting their hands on these drugs?
Well, it is hard to determine. I think probably most the people, probably almost all the people who end up actually dying from using these drugs are using them or abusing them in a way that the doctor didn't prescribe. But when it gets down to it is, I think doctors wrote, there's for opium-based painkillers, doctors wrote something like 200 million prescriptions last year. Now, originally you'd think that's like one prescription for every 2 out of 3 people in America, although they usually, when they prescribe them for like a month. So if you're getting 12 prescriptions in a year, the percentage is probably no more than 1 in 5 people in America, which is still a big number. 20% of America could be using these prescriptions-based drugs. So most of these drugs were designed for either like intensive cancer treatments or like surgery. And the Center for Disease Control is saying that they really should never be prescribed for more than 3 days under a doctor's direct supervision, although it's becoming quite common to get them prescribed for 30 days for things like a wisdom tooth removal or a muscle spasm or something that's a chronic pain. This was never meant for these opioid-based pills. They were meant for acute surgery procedures. They were never meant for chronic pain. And when you use them for chronic pain, there is a risk you could be addicted, and there's an even greater risk that if they're just willy-nilly prescribing 200 million prescription of these, that there's just a lot of them floating around. Maybe they're being used by the people who got the prescription. Maybe they decide their wisdom tooth pain wasn't that bad and they don't take them. But if they don't take them, they're still in that medicine cabinet. Mm-hmm. And there is a risk that someone else could get them and use them improperly.
Right. So why would the doctors be over-prescribing these serious, powerful drugs that really do have significant side effects?
Right. Well, I guess there's probably the cynic in you if you try to think about it. But I mean, pharmaceutical companies, you don't make money by curing people. You make money by selling pills. And so you're getting a lot of these things where they're given just like free coupons. You get these pharmaceutical representatives, you give your free coupons or all these great, great deals to just to try to push these drugs to keep them flowing so that you've got your profit margins coming in.
So how much are they incentivizing that? Say the doctors, the relationship between the pharmaceutical industry and the doctors, what's some of the evidence showing just how much this is a mutually beneficial relationship that doesn't necessarily operate on the best interests of the patients?
Right. Well, you've definitely, they're getting a lot of, they're coming down much harder now on just you're trying to get like pharmaceutical reps trying to sell drugs that'll really come up with some good financial incentives or good deals for doctors to be able to get maybe free discounts somewhere else if they can sell so many of these. And in some extreme cases, I think they said someone who is a doctor in Kentucky who was just arrested for basically operating like a kind of cartel operative where he was actually writing prescriptions to people who didn't have pain problems. They just wanted to get high. And of course, that's definitely illegal. But even for the legal standpoint, where the Center for Disease Control is like, no, this should be something like if you've had an intensive surgery to just get you back on your feet for a few days. I think they said that 99% of doctors break the 3-day recommendation the Center for Disease Control has put out there.
So the Center for Disease Control is issuing these warnings and recommendations for the extent to which a prescription should be given, but so much of the behavior of the pharmaceutical industry is in direct contradiction to that.
Right. The pharmaceutical industry, they're a business. They're trying to sell the drugs they produce, so they're trying to get doctors to write more of these prescriptions. The Center for Disease Control is a government agency that's worried about addiction. Mm-hmm. So they're saying, like, don't prescribe more than 3 days and then have them come back in and check up on them and make sure that nothing's going wrong, because there are some people who are just more likely to be addicted. I think right now my working introduction for the article I'm working on is kind of telling the story, which might be more of one of the more extreme stories, of a man in Florida who just he was a varsity athlete. He was on, he'd taken pain medication for most of his life, but then had a knee surgery and had his doctor give him a month-long prescription for Oxycontin, which is an opium-based painkiller. And it just must have been something with his body type, is that was within only like a week, you're supposed to wait 12 hours before you take it. And he was getting addicted to it. So he was started crushing. I mean, it's supposed to be time released, but he just, if you he was starting to crush them to get just like the immediate opium high, and ended up getting real addicted. And in his case, actually, I think his doctor got concerned that he was getting addicted, so just kind of cut him off, which not a great decision. Like I said, once you've got a drug addict on your hand, you need rehab. Because I think in a lot of these cases, they say that 75% of heroin users start out on opium-based prescription drugs. And that eventually, especially now that the government's starting to realize how addictive these pills are, they've been on the market since about the mid-90s, they're really trying to crack down on some of these doctors and get them to be more careful about who they prescribe to. But when you've got, I think they say there's like 7 million something like 7 million people in the nation who are already using these pills improperly. And now if you're starting to cut back, you've got an addiction and you can't get more, you switch over to heroin as your substitute. It's more available and it's cheaper.
So you're studying into this, looking at a figure like 47,000 people dying of drug overdoses. This is a social catastrophe. And comparing what's happening from the business, from the drug cartels, and what's flowing over the border from Mexico and that type of thing, you're realizing that in comparison to what's happening really kind of legally and through channels that aren't being focused on so much, they really don't have, there's really no comparison between these two.
Right. You would definitely, the people, dying from pharmaceutical pills, there's twice as many of them as the ones that are getting drugs from the cartels in Mexico. But I think what I'm really trying to focus on in this article is just the fact that it's easy to view some of the problems with the pharmaceutical industry as one issue, and then some of the problems with this criminal drug cartels is another issue. And just trying to point out that no, it's actually really big of a much bigger story on America's problems with substance abuse. Say that close to 2/3 of Americans are using some type of prescription drug.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then of those, the Center for Disease Control, that probably half of those who are on prescription drugs are abusing them. So that's about 1/3 of Americans abusing prescription drugs.
And then at the same time, you have this whole debate going on in the United States about the legalization of marijuana, where people are, here's another drug that's legal and it can be distributed legally within certain states. Right now it's up for a vote in, I think it's 8 more states this coming November.
Yeah. Cause that's, well, the prescription drugs, I think their usage, they've increased 400% in the last 20 years. Marijuana usage has doubled, since some of these legalization efforts have started to take root. Which and a lot of people are attributing that as kind of like the dual cause of the heroin crisis. Heroin deaths have also increased about 400% in the last 20 years. But they said before, where the cartels were growing these mass marijuana fields in Mexico and then smuggling those into the nations, now that legalization efforts are getting marijuana easier to get, even though twice as many people are using it, the cartels are still losing some money because they can grow it themselves or buy it from someone who's growing it themselves. But since the early 90s, Joaquin Guzman and the Sinaloa cartels had his eye on this opium-based drug addiction because he knows those pills are expensive. And he knows if people get hooked on them, the closest chemical compound to that drug is heroin. So now they're saying that a lot of the big marijuana fields in Mexico are they're lying fallow as they replant with poppies because they really there's not the money in marijuana that there used to be. There's too much of a domestic market. But if they can grow poppies and distill that into heroin, once you get someone with, addicted to these opium-based painkillers, either if their doctor cuts them off and they can't get them anymore, or they're expensive painkillers, so if you can't afford them anymore, heroin would be a cheaper illegal alternative to that.
A pretty scary situation when you have an alignment of interests between the pharmaceutical industry and the Sinaloa drug cartel.
Right. And in a lot of ways, I mean, some of the more extreme cases, it is kind of hard to tell the difference sometimes, especially this doctor who was arrested for writing prescriptions. I mean, he's no better than a drug lord. But even some of the pharmaceutical reps that are getting a little overeager here, and they're like, well, we have so many of these pills we manufactured this year, and we need to sell all of them, and these doctors aren't writing enough prescriptions, so we need to make some sort of
economic inducement
to get them to sell more. And there's a very fine line between, like, how are you different than Joaquin Guzman? I mean, you're probably not boiling people in acid, but you are still selling drugs to people who don't need them to inflate your own pocketbook.
You know, I think you really do get to the heart of the issue when you talk about just the demand and how much it really is a character issue individually. If people are relying on these drugs and they're going after them more and more, there's a void there that they're trying to fill with these artificial means, and that's always going to lead to problems. I look forward to reading that article. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller. He's working on this article that you can watch for on thetrumpet.com. Very interesting story, Andrew. We appreciate you bringing it to us.
Thank you.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Most people dismiss the Bible as being unreliable, that it's full of myth and legend. It's convoluted because of many generations of translations of translations. But that belief ignores a great deal of evidence showing just how accurate and reliable the Bible actually is and how meticulously it has been preserved for us today. Some very interesting and compelling evidence of the Bible's reliability comes from the field of archaeology. Recent years have yielded several finds that back up the biblical account. I have a man here who has been personally involved in some of those finds. He's worked on archaeological digs in Jerusalem that have provided tangible evidence of King Solomon, King David, Jeremiah, Nehemiah, and other biblical personalities. Via Skype from our office in the United Kingdom, I have Chris Eames. Hello, Chris.
How do you do?
Doing very well. Happy to talk with you. Appreciate you taking the time to talk with us about this. I'd like to start by just talking about some of the recent findings that that are of interest in this respect. Let's start by just talking about King Belshazzar.
Sure. King Belshazzar is a very interesting historical character, shall we say, because he wasn't actually known to history outside of the Bible up until relatively recent years, historically speaking. He was an object of ridicule, really, for historians, because it was well known that the last king of Babylon was Nabonidus. Histories are clear about this, but yet the Bible, in the book of Daniel, specifically chapter 5, says that King Belshazzar was the last king of Babylon when the Persians came in, sacked the city, and killed King Belshazzar. And so this is a great conundrum, a great confusion. How on earth can King Belshazzar exist when history so clearly states that King Nabonidus was the last king of Babylon? And there was this confusion right up until around 1850, around the 1850s. There was a discovery made in an ancient Babylonian city of Ur, currently in modern-day Iraq. And there a British consul stumbled on what has become known as the Nabonidus cylinder. And the cylinder reads as follows. As for Belshazzar, Nabonidus here speaking, as for Belshazzar, the eldest son, the offspring of my heart, the fair of great divinity, cause you to exist in his heart. And let not sin possess him, let him be satisfied with fullness of life. Now, this is an amazing discovery that was made because it shows Nabonidus himself writing down that he has a son called Belshazzar. And if we look even further into the history, we see that Nabonidus spent much of his later years in the eastern part of the empire and actually had left the son, his eldest son here, Belshazzar, in charge of the actual city of Babylon as the de facto king. So it's an incredible link up there of what the Bible says and what archaeology, what science itself says to confirm that record.
Okay, so this is a discovery that was made in the mid-19th century that changed the historian's view of that Babylonian history. What about more recent finds that have changed historians' view?
Okay, if we look at quite a fairly recent find, one in particular is referring to King David. Now, up until just over 20 years ago, David was only known through history from the biblical account. And so you have a lot of scholars, a lot of historians. And speaking in Israel, a lot of historians, specifically from the Tel Aviv University upbringing, who began thinking that David, if he existed at all, was some kind of a legendary tribal chieftain, some kind of small chieftain with not really much power to wield at all. And that began changing that view after 1993 excavations in a place called Tel Dan. And that is a city up there in northern Israel. And what was found was a large stone with some quite nice writing on it. Now, the stone was found in secondary use. That means it's not fulfilling the first intent of the stone. It was designed as a victory stone, something to be presented and shown to the world, and in the secondary use, it was found as a building block, as part of an Israelite building. Now, the first use of the stone is, it appears to have belonged to Hazael, king of Syria, and it describes him basically boasting about what he has done during his reign. And it's got text on it, which reads as follows. And I killed two powerful kings who harnessed 2,000 chariots and 2,000 horsemen. I killed Joram, the son of Ahab, king of Israel, and I killed Ahaziah, the son of Joram. Some of these Hebrew names are hard. Son of Joram, king of the house of David, and I said, and it follows. So here is a unique mention of the term house of David. Now, the dating to the stone is at least 100 years after David would have reigned. And so that in itself is quite interesting because it shows that David was such a prolific king that even up to 100 years later, those who ruled under that Judean monarchy were still referring to themselves as the House of David, that powerful title established by King David himself.
And that that timetable and the personalities involved align with the biblical record as well?
That's right. It confirms a couple of other Israelite kings and actually specifically refers to the nation as Israel. And that's interesting as well because it becomes one of only four artifacts, this being one, the other three being the Misha Stela, the Menepta Stela, and the Kirk Monolith, that actually refer to the term Israel at all. You have other references, such as the land of Canaan and such like that, but this is one of only four that specifically reference the term Israel.
And just briefly, maybe you could make mention of some of the work that you've been involved in personally in the Palace of David, where that's located and what that tells us about the biblical accuracy of the account of David.
Okay. what has been going on recently archaeologically in Israel is an archaeologist by the name of Dr. Eilat Mazar has been conducting several excavations in the city of Jerusalem, in the City of David area. And I've had the awesome opportunity to be there for a couple of those excavations, some of which happened in that City of David and some a little further north on the Ophel. But as you mentioned, in the City of David area, she has discovered what she believes, and we as archaeologists believe, is the palace of King David. And she bases that fact on a huge structure, immensely wide walls, that was found in that City of David area, that was supported underneath by an immense structure termed the Stepstone Structure. And Dr. Mazar discovered that and believes from that the Jebusites weren't strong enough of a power before David came along in order to build something as large as that. And once David came along, the kingdom was consolidated and he had more resources to build up a powerful, strong area as the Stepstone Structure and the large structure on top of that. And to go towards proving that, you have a reference in the Bible of David being up in his palace, and when there was a war going on, he would go down into a fortified section of the city. So his palace was up on high somewhere in the city, and he went down from it. And this is, in terms of the City of David, the highest area in that city. Obviously, it gets a little higher as you go north into the Ophel and the Temple Mount area. But as we know, King David himself didn't extend his kingdom there. That was left to Solomon to build his palace up further north. But in terms of the City of David, that was the highest point in the city, and the large structure there confirms that it must have been a majestic building and surely the palace of King David.
Another discovery that confirms a New Testament account. Tell us about Pontius Pilate.
Sure. Pontius Pilate was a Judean prefect of the Roman Empire who, as we know, delivered Jesus Christ to be scourged and crucified. And the Bible description was really the main thing people had to go on to prove his existence. There were a couple of brief later Roman histories, possibly derived from the Bible themselves. So there wasn't much proof to go on in terms of his existence, and you would think for a Roman prefect or someone in that position, you should have a whole lot of documentation proving their existence. And all that changed until 1961, and at that time a unique white stone was found in the city of Caesarea, and that stone was somewhat damaged. It dates to around 26 to 37 AD. And basically, the English translation of what was written on that stone reads, "To the honorable gods, this Tiberium, Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judea, had dedicated," and it's broken off right there. So from the stone, that dates right to the exact period that we would expect to see Pontius Pilate ruling the area, we see the stone confirming his existence and his position in the Roman government.
Any other archaeological proof of New Testament accounts?
Sure, there's quite a lot. I've got an article coming out about it for the trumpet.com website. One of the other finds that I mention in that is related to the Politarchs mentioned by Luke. And so I'll just mention that briefly. Luke is an unusual writer, was originally considered an unusual writer because he used a lot of terms that were otherwise unknown to historians. And they thought, well, we see all these words that we don't recognize in typical Greek writing. What does this mean? Is it from a different kind of period? Is he using words that are essentially made up? And there are a number of these different words he uses, and one of them is referring to the leadership term of politarch, and that's referenced in Acts 17, verse 6 and verse 8, the rulers of the city being politarchs. And scientists' thoughts on his writings and on this word in particular changed when a large stone monument, basically, that would have stood above a doorway, read an inscription that began with the word Politarchus. And this word Politarchus, meaning to act as a politarch, to be a ruler of the city, essentially, in the English translation of the Bible, confirms Luke's account and joins many other archaeological confirmations of different words that Luke has written. Words such as Areopagite, Grammatius, Anthropotoi, lots of weird Greek words. So archaeology has just gone to prove Luke's account. And Luke was a detailed writer as well. In his accounts, we read that he's a physician by trade. And this just goes to show he knew how to wield the language. He knew what he was talking about. He was a skilled doctor, a skilled physician. And so we should have no reason in this day and age to question his grip on the language.
Very interesting. And some of these examples that you've put together in this Trumpet.com article are, I had not heard of them before. Well, this is obviously a subject that we cover from time to time in the Trumpet. And we actually have sent some of our staff to Jerusalem to dig, including yourself, something that we really do have a great interest in. Chris, can you give our listeners an idea of where they could get more information about this if they were interested in learning more about some of these discoveries?
Sure. Aside from a search of the trumpet.com website, we do have a website specifically linked to the excavations that happen periodically in Jerusalem. You can visit that on thekeytodavidcity.com. That's all as one word, thekeytodavidcity.com. And on that website, you'll find previous excavations that have occurred on the Ophel. We only got that website started 2012, I think. So far, we've only had two separate excavations on there. But hopefully, as one excavation looks like it might be cropping up here in the next few months or so, we'll be able to add more information about that. But we'll have to keep you posted on that.
Well, wonderful. We've been talking with trumpet writer Chris Eames. He's, as we've said, written an article about this subject. You can watch for that online on thetrumpet.com. We appreciate your time, Chris.
Thank you very much.
It's time for today's last word.
How well do you know yourself? Not just your desires or interests. How well do you understand how and why you think your particular thoughts? What makes you do what you do? Be honest. Are there ever times when you have thoughts you don't like or don't understand, or even worse, emotions you can't explain? Do you ever feel disappointed because you keep doing things you've promised yourself you'd overcome? In your relationships, do you find yourself dealing with the same problems, making the same mistakes time and time again? Surely we can all answer yes to at least some of these questions. Why? Because they're common to the human experience. Even the Apostle Paul, one of the most prolific biblical writers, was well acquainted with these frustrations. In Romans 7 and verse 15, he wrote, "I do not understand my own actions, for I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate." Why is this the case? Sometimes it seems as if our own minds are a big puzzle. Think about how our minds are so easily drawn to things that are forbidden to us. Advertisers take advantage of this human tendency all the time. Books and movies and art exhibits that arouse scandal tend to attract bigger audiences. Think about that. Why does reverse psychology work on us? Why can it be so effective where we do something only because it's the opposite of what is expected? Why do we naturally resist when we're told what to do or when we know that something is right? Why is it so hard to admit when we're wrong? Can you explain these conundrums? Again, how well do you really know yourself? How well do you know the inner workings of your mind? Most people just live with the problem. They don't think much about it. They think, well, life is complicated enough without trying to unriddle yourself. Other people who are desperate for a solution, they think that they'll believe every promise of every self-help book, every television psychiatrist or psychic, or they'll build their lives around humanly devised plans and programs. The Bible states the problem in terminology that is shockingly explicit, so much so that most people would reject it, even though they are living proof of its truth. Jeremiah 17 and verse 9 says, "The heart, that is the seat of intellect, the human mind, is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it?" That's what the Bible says. Do you disagree? Does that seem too harsh? It takes penetrating personal honesty to recognize the rightness in Jeremiah's statement. 1 Kings 8 and verse 38 talks about the importance of every person knowing the plague of his own heart. Does that ring true in your life? Do you recognize that plague in your mind? If you don't admit it, you can never change it. The fact is, most of the problems in this world are caused by people who are woefully ignorant about themselves. They may be doing the best they know how, they may sincerely desire to do better, but they're stuck. As Proverbs 16 verse 25 says, "There is a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death." Why is the human mind so malignant? The Creator God designed it. Did He fashion it in all those deceptive intricacies? Did He make it desperately wicked? Most people have never even contemplated that issue. Perhaps more important, what can be done about it? Recognizing the problem is one thing, overcoming it is another altogether. Are we destined to remain plagued by a self-deceitful and wicked heart? These are important questions, pressing questions that you need the answers to. I'd like to offer you free copies of two booklets. The first is called Human Nature, What Is It? This will explain why the human mind is the way it is. And the second is called Repentance Toward God. This will show the first steps necessary to begin to change. It'll give the universally overlooked key to self-mastery and to lasting success. The Bible really does explain how to understand the inner workings of your own mind. Take advantage of that truth that only God makes available to you. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Robert Morley, Andrew Miller, and Chris Eames. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Marcus Aurelius. Execute every act of thy life as though it were thy last. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been
been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.